Funding for Think comes from SMU Doctor and Master of Liberal Studies programs.
The Declaration of Independence calls it self-evident that all men are created equal. But in practice, life in America often doesn't work that way, and the economic inequality is getting worse over time. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. As a whole, white families in this country are accumulating assets at three times the rate of their black neighbors. And the wealth gap persists, even among people who earn the same amount for their work. The only way to fully understand the problem, my guest insists, is to consider financial well-being and race together. Thomas M. Shapiro is professor of law and social policy and director of the Institute on Assets and Social Policy at Brandeis University. His new book is called Toxic Inequality: How America's Wealth Gap Destroys Mobility, Deepens the Racial Divide, and Threatens Our Future. Tom, welcome to Think.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
I want to start with an essential question. What is the difference between wealth and income?
It's a great distinction that most Americans really don't key in on. Essentially, income is what we get, the value of our work. It's returned in the paycheck, or if we can't work or too old, it comes in Social Security or disability. And for almost all American families, that flow of income, and if we think of it as a stream that flows by, we use virtually all of that to reproduce our daily lives, our rent, our mortgage, our food, our clothing, et cetera. And there's very little left over for most American families at the end of the month. Wealth is something a bit different. It's more like a pond. It's a storehouse of financial resources that we've not expended, or we've inherited, or we've invested. And essentially, it's everything that has financial value. Stocks, bonds, savings accounts, even cars, home equity, for example, businesses and other investments, minus all of our debts. And there's a big distinction there between what average family income is and what average family wealth is. Most American families have very little, if any, financial wealth.
Yeah, so we can find ourselves experiencing asset poverty even if we have enough income most of the time to pay all our expenses.
That's absolutely right. One report that I saw recently talks about how about a half of American families don't have $500 in savings. And $500 in savings is A, not a whole lot of money, and B, that amount of savings is really kind of an emergency fund that folks need for when the car might break down or there's a health mishap or some other crisis.
All right. Before we move on, I want to get to one more very basic question.
Sure.
Why is economic inequality a problem for society as a whole? Because your argument is that it's not simply a problem for the people who experience it, but really for all of us.
That's right. That comes out in the title of the book, Toxic Inequality. And what I'm trying to do in naming the book Toxic Inequality is to distinguish the era that we're in right now in the United States. And I would suggest we've been here for maybe 20 years or so. It's a very different kind of inequality than we have always experienced in the United States. And every society that we've recorded in history has some amount of inequality. So the issue is not so much inequality, but it's really about what the levels, the thresholds, and the impact that it has on society. So, for example, in the United States today, we have historic high levels of both income inequality and wealth inequality. And that takes us, you know, historic highs takes us back right before the Depression era, which is sort of the first time we have any financial information about family wealth per se. Now, that level of inequality by itself, I would suggest, is bad enough. But we also have to look at the situation, the context that this widening inequality is occurring in. It's occurring in an era that I would, and other economists and historians, track back to the early 1970s, an era in which family economic mobility has essentially stalled, that is, the ability to do better than our parents. Living standards in the United States have also stagnated since about the early to mid-1970s. So we have an evil convergence, if you will, of a couple of sets of forces that deepen the level of inequality. And then I would sort of throw into that mix the notion of the racial wealth gap. And as you mentioned in your intro, the racial wealth gap in the United States is very wide to begin with. In fact, the one piece of data that I'm always extremely struck by in terms of just how stark it is that the average, the typical, the median African-American family has 8 cents in wealth for every dollar that the median white family has.
Wow.
And for Hispanic families, it's about 9 or 9.5 cents. That is a little less than a dime of wealth for every dollar of wealth that that median white family has. And that racial wealth gap, if we look at the same set of families over 29 years, which we did in one of our studies, that gap tripled. And that's startling to me.
So how is it that white families are somehow more insulated from economic inequality, from asset poverty, than their neighbors of color?
Well, I think there are a number of really profound reasons for that. One has to do with the historical legacy of race and wealth in the United States. I don't think we need a whole long history lesson to remember that for a long period of time, African Americans simply were not allowed to own property. That includes homes. Titles to properties that they might have acquired were extremely suspect and sometimes taken away, legally or not. It was extremely hard for African Americans to start businesses that didn't go beyond the borders of serving their own communities. And we don't even have to go that far back in time. We can go back to, say, for example, the Social Security Act, 1934, 1935. When that act was passed, which was, I think, a great piece of legislation in terms of the social insurance it provides for and retirement security it provides for most American families. Nonetheless, when Social Security was first passed, it excluded by legal definition the exact occupations that most African Americans and most Hispanics labored in. That is agricultural labor, railroad work, domestic work. And so for many years, actually up until the 1960s, for farm workers, for example, they were excluded from the system that included virtually all white workers and many workers of color as well, but those occupations had been excluded. So the ability in our past to acquire, to accumulate, to grow financial wealth has been extremely limited for African Americans. Now, having said that, the fact of the matter is that most white families don't have a lot of financial assets either. In fact, I think the data is something like 44% of white families also fall below an asset poverty line. So there's great inequity in distribution even within the white community. And then finally, wealth, unlike income, is a financial resource that has the capacity to be passed along from one generation to another. So if a group had financial assets and the ability to accumulate wealth virtually excluded, there was nothing to pass along or very little to pass along. That's a condition that applied most of the time to African Americans and Hispanics, not quite so much to whites in the United States.
And not only very little to pass along if they were excluded from Social Security, but in fact, elder relatives would be, we don't want to be unkind about it, but a burden on the next generation rising behind them.
Well, that's a great question. In one of the chapters in the book, we were able to look at some data over a couple of decades that were asking families, do you receive financial assistance from your parents or grandparents? And what we find in that data, and this is replicated, by the way, in the nearly 200 families that we interviewed for this study in depth over a period of 12 years, the typical pattern is that white families tend to receive financial resources from their elders, from the generation above them. For young adults, that can be significant financial help. In fact, of the families we personally interviewed for our study, every single homeowner, whether it was white or black, by the way, bought their first home with significant financial help from their parents, helping them with the down payment money. Now, that applies pretty regularly to white families. Interestingly, what the studies tell us is that for families of color, African American, Hispanic families, and immigrant families in particular, the flow of resources tends to go the other direction, just as you were mentioning. It tends to go, especially from somewhat successful adults, it tends to go to their elderly parents, aunts and uncles, and grandparents. And that's, throughout the world, that's actually a more typical pattern of the flow of resources and reciprocity of helping those in your immediate kinship network that need it.
So is that why that first generation, often of people of color who have been college educated and get what we call good jobs, air quotes, you know, jobs that pay pretty well, they are more susceptible to falling back into poverty than the people they went to school with, earn the same grades as, have the same jobs as, but happen to be white?
Well, I think there's a large degree of truth to that. The data we look at, I would put it in a slightly different narrative, if you will. We looked at, it's a study we did for the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis about a year ago. We presented this at a conference. And what they wanted us to look at was to help explain a puzzle to them. And this was the puzzle. College-educated whites over a period of 20 or 30 years, we saw that their income grew quite dramatically in many cases, and their wealth grew. And that's what one might expect. A young professional graduating college, going into the labor market, they keep doing better over the course of years, and life gets better for them, and financially at least. But we didn't see the same pattern with African American college graduates. Yes, the income increased almost as much as it did for whites. So that's great news. Income, in fact, does education rather, in fact, does really pay off in terms of lifetime earnings. But here was the puzzle. The puzzle was that the wealth of college-educated black graduates that we studied actually decreased. And this is what the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis had found in an earlier study and was trying to help figure out, well, my gosh, what's going on there? And what we were able to come up with when we looked pretty deeply is that inheritance played a large role. And as I mentioned before, college-educated African Americans tend to be the most successful in their family or kinship network. And the most successful families in those networks that have needy parents, grandparents, folks that need financial assistance, health insurance, helping a niece go to community college, it's that successful African American college graduate that gives financial assistance to those around her or him. And that, we think, partly explains why it is that African-American college graduates' wealth actually decreases. It's not that they're spending it frivolously or gambling it away or buying $300 worth of sneakers for their kids and everything like that. No, it's about how whites inherit more. Some African-Americans do inherit as well, but not nearly as many. And the money flows out to other members of their kinship networks.
My guest is Thomas M. Shapiro, professor of law and social policy and director of the Institute on Assets and Social Policy at Brandeis University. We're talking about his new book, Toxic Inequality: How America's Wealth Gap Destroys Mobility, Deepens the Racial Divide, and Threatens Our Future. You can join the conversation now by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org, or you can find us on Twitter at @KERAThink.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, where students can pursue their passion. You can study social justice and build activism skills with summer courses like education, equality, and human rights. You can apply now at smu.edu/MLS.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Thomas M. Shapiro of Brandeis University, where he's director of the Institute on Assets and Social Policy. We're talking about his new book, Toxic Inequality: How America's Wealth Gap Destroys Mobility, Deepens the Racial Divide, and Threatens Our Future. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. Tom, will you talk about how we are still affected by discriminatory housing policies that were amended or eliminated decades ago?
Sure. This is, you know, I think this is probably the most complicated, difficult conversation to have because the remedies are not easy. I think it's somewhat, it's a lot easier to point to the history and the legacy, but it's the puzzle of what to do about it is really quite profound. So yes, since the early and mid-1960s, finally at the federal level, often preceded by state legislation, anybody can own property by law, but the custom hasn't necessarily changed. So I'm a sociologist by discipline. Sociologists and the demographers have been really good about understanding statistically and narratively what residential segregation looks like in the United States. To simplify a very complicated story, essentially newer cities, maybe some of the newer cities in Texas and the Southwest that tend to be more the smaller cities that have grown as well, residential segregation has been breaking down a little bit, but still is quite profound. In the more northern cities, the older cities and the larger cities in particular, residential segregation has persisted to an extremely high degree. By residential segregation, we simply mean communities that are largely or relatively homogeneous, one race or ethnicity. And as we see those communities in the United States, which, as I said, the residential segregation is pretty high and pretty persistent, in most areas of the country, school systems and eligibility for what schools you attend map or track on to who lives, the demographics, who lives in a community. So residential segregation also tends to translate into a very high correlation of school segregation as well. That's broken down, at least legally, but not by custom. Now, maybe some people might think, all right, what difference does it make? Well, I would argue, first of all, that sort of ethically, philosophically, morally, I think there's a very profound question about living with those that don't always look exactly like you and think exactly like you benefits everybody. But that's an open conversation. I know what is uncontroversible is that a home that's located in a relatively white, especially if it's an upper middle class community, has increases in value. That is, the wealth it creates over time in terms of its home equity is far greater than the wealth that's created by the exact same home, built in the same year, the same architectural style, the same interior design, same square footage, same number of blades of grass. If that home is located in a community of color, much less a diverse community, that home doesn't increase in value nearly as much as it does in that upper middle class, relatively homogeneous white community.
All right, let me interrupt you for a second because I want to unpack that. Why would two different neighborhoods, one inhabited mostly by people of color and one mostly by white people, with exactly the same housing stock, see real estate values rise and fall at different rates?
So if we had a show of realtors, they would give us the realtor mantra, location, location, location. Let's unpack that. What that really means is the demographics of the peers in the community and who attends and the peers of and the demographics of who attends the local or community schools. Let me try this example. If I own a home, whether it's in Boston or Austin, it the example probably really won't matter for the moment. If I own a home in a relatively homogeneous white upper middle class community, which is who I am, and I want to sell that home, the only barrier to who can buy that home I would argue deeply is if you have the finances and the economics, anybody can buy that home. All whites that can afford it, African Americans, Hispanics, whomever you are. So the market for that home is 100% of those who can afford it. Now, if I own that exact same home in a community that has transitioned to be, hypothetically, let's say 40% white, 60% families of color, the data tell us that the market for who can buy that home is no longer 100% of those who can afford it, because most whites will no longer want to live in a community where they feel that they are the minority or that they're underrepresented. And that's a different kind of market that operates. And yes, the value on that house is probably lower to begin with, but once that house is purchased, the equity, that is, the amount it increases over time, is not nearly as great as the house in the white community. That's how you can get the exact same house, but look, that's why location and demographics of the community really matter.
Okay, why does the mortgage interest deduction benefit wealthy families more than those that are struggling? I can't imagine it was created to help rich people buy nicer houses.
No, so let's do the blue sky analysis here. Let's say the mortgage interest deduction doesn't exist, and Chris and I come along and say, we have a great idea. And the idea is, let's allow people to take the interest that they pay on their mortgage off of their taxes as a tax expenditure. It does, so it won't appear on the budget, but it's taxes we don't pay. Somebody else has got to make it up. And by the way, not everybody can take it the same rate. We'll calibrate it to your tax bracket. So those in the higher tax brackets can take off a higher percentage of the interest they pay. And if you buy a much bigger, more expensive home, you can even take more off, because the interest that you're paying is much, very likely to be higher. And finally, the GAO, the government has done the estimates on it, and they tell us the following. Great idea, Tom and Chris, but here's what the distribution looks like. 86% of that tax expenditure, of the federal subsidy to allow people to buy homes, is going to go to the top 10%. Now, I may be cynical at times, but I doubt, had this policy didn't exist, that it would not pass even this Congress. But that's not where we start from. We start from a history. This is exactly where we have ended up, though. Let me give just a couple of data points. Today, the mortgage interest deduction, actually, let me just say home ownership, because it includes mortgage interest deduction, the property taxes that can be taken off of state and federal taxes, the capital gains up to a certain level that a homeowner is not liable for after they sell a home. Those three big factors amount to about $200 billion every year to subsidize home ownership in the United States. Now, I happen to think that housing security and housing affordability, along with home ownership, is actually a good policy. And the government and the public in some way should invest in that, because there's a lot of literature that tells us people who own things and feel part of a community, not necessarily owners, are much more stable, much more active community members, much more active citizens, better neighbors. There's a whole string of literature that in the social sciences that back that up. But that's not necessarily the case in the United States. So we spend the $200 billion a year, and as I said, 86% of that every single year goes to the top 10%. There's some easy fixes. We can go in a room with, you know, 10 listeners, and believe me, within 5 minutes we could put a cap on it. We could make it flat. We could do all kinds of things that would make it much more equitable, while at the same time still serving the public good and goals of helping housing security in the United States.
What's so interesting about this, Tom, is that I think a lot of homeowners who take the mortgage interest deduction don't think of that as a housing subsidy. And a lot of those same people might really be appalled at the idea of giving subsidies to people who, say, rent their housing.
Well, unfortunately, you're right. First, you know, I do think it's important to understand that a lot of homeowners, if you've not owned your home for a long period of time, there's some complications in it. But within the first or 10 to 15 years of owning a particular home, a lot of homeowners actually benefit from the home mortgage deduction, and it helps to subsidize it. It's figuratively, not literally, but it's figuratively as if the federal government has publicly invested and written you a check to help subsidize your home ownership every single year. And a lot of us, myself included, we count on that. And it helps us. It helps us in our calculation about what kind of home we can buy. It helps us at income tax time and a lot of other things. The problem, again, is that it's not it is the way it actually actively redistributes wealth to the top. And that's a big problem. Now, I mentioned that we invest as a society about $200 billion a year in home ownership, arguably for people who don't need it, who would be homeowners anyways. Let's table that for the moment. If we were to ask people on the street what the housing policy of the United States government is, I would bet you that most people by far would say it's subsidized rent, it's public housing, and to some extent it is. That's what we think. That's what we think as the entitlement or the giveaway, whatever the pejorative that's put on, you know, helping people find shelter. We spend as a society about $40 billion a year on that. And I invite our listeners to weigh the balance. If budgets actually provide priority, which they do, then the real housing policy of the United States government is our public investment in subsidizing home ownership, five times greater than what we do to help people who can't afford it subsidize their rent and find shelter.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Thomas M. Shapiro. We're talking about his book, Toxic Inequality: How America's Wealth Gap Destroys Mobility, Deepens the Racial Divide, and Threatens Our Future. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. We have Dick on the line now in Highland Village. Hi, Dick.
Hi, how you doing? Sir, I've always heard that the corporate executives, specifically CEOs in the nation of Japan, have a salary cap that's based on a certain percentage over and above that of their average workers. If that's true, is it simply because they have more of a social understanding or feeling towards social equality versus what we do here, where corporate executives seem to continue to get more and more and more, and enough is never enough?
What do you know about that, Tom?
I think it's a question. It's a great question. there are several societies. I think Japan is probably the most well-known that has essential guidelines for looking at a corporation and what its median or average worker earns. And the top executives can't earn more than, just for example, eight times that. That's just, I'm throwing that off the top of my head. I don't know what the exact number is. And the idea there is one that says inequality is okay, because they actually think that those in higher levels of an organization put more in and are more productive and create more value and all those good things in economic terms. Therefore, they need to be paid a little more. But at the same time, there's a threshold, there's a ceiling that cannot be passed, because that's the point at which inequality becomes toxic or dangerous to the culture of that particular corporation, and I would suggest the culture of a society as well. Now, interestingly, maybe, and I would put air quotes around the word interestingly here, similar kinds of legislation has been passed in some states in the United States, but unfortunately for Dick and myself and many other people, it doesn't relate to the private sector of the economy. It relates to the public sector, most particularly not-for-profits and universities, where the top leadership is not supposed to be paid a multiple of, again, 10 or whatever the number is, over the median salary of those in that particular institution. So for some reason as a society, we think it's okay to provide that multiple cap. You know, the top leader can't earn more than X amount of the middle worker in an organization, but only if it's a university or a not-for-profit. We don't dare think about or even do the same thing in the private sector.
If race is an inextricable part of the problem of income inequality in America, how do we need to factor in race as we try to craft solutions?
Well, we've been trying for a long time, and I would actually suggest there's some successes to look at. There's a lot of successes to look at, but that glass is about half, I would suggest, half full, and there's still a lot of ways to go. I think the Equal Employment Acts, I think equal access and opportunity to higher education and community colleges was essentially the way that the African-American middle class was created through legislation that opened up doors and barriers that had been too high before the 1960s in particular. And families of color that were able to take advantage of that and have their adult children educated to become professionals have, you know, widened the African American middle class by multitudes. Now, unfortunately, at the same time, we still experience loads of what people are now referring to as implicit bias. I would also suggest there is explicit bias as well. And so, let me give one quick example. There's a sort of a famous study that sent out resumes, dummy resumes, where the exact same qualifications were listed, the same education, the same skills, all the way down the line from A to Z, except the palpable, readable names for one set of these resumes were African-American names and the other were white names. And the result of the study showed that getting a call to an interview and a callback to an interview was much more difficult if the name was African-American sounding in any way. In fact, another study came very close to that, and you know, maybe we'll get a chance to talk about that when we have some calls.
All right, we will come back to the conversation in just a moment. My guest is Thomas M. Shapiro, professor of law and social policy at Brandeis University. His book is called Toxic Inequality: How America's Wealth Gap Destroys Mobility, Deepens the Racial Divide, and Threatens Our Future. We'll be back to the conversation in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program for working adults interested in human-centered leadership. You can take courses this fall like Personhood in the Age of Corporate Enterprise. You can apply now at smu.edu/MLS.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Thomas M. Shapiro, who is director of the Institute on Assets and Social Policy at Brandeis University and has written a book called Toxic Inequality: How America's Wealth Gap Destroys Mobility, Deepens the Racial Divide, and Threatens Our Future. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or find us on Twitter at KERAThink. Tom, inevitably when we have a conversation like this, we will hear from someone who says, I am white. I don't come from a wealthy family, and I don't feel like I am getting like my situation, which is maybe identical to some of my neighbors of color, is getting any attention. Are the solutions that we're about to talk about in this third segment of the program that consider race as they are formed and created, are they also beneficial to white people with modest incomes and not a lot of family assets?
Absolutely. I'm a firm believer in what I would call targeted universalism. That is where if we think about what the goal of a policy might be, whether it's economic security, whether it's access to college, whether it's a minimum wage, and then think about the means that that get differently situated groups there, whites fall within those categories as well. I would like to go back to reminding myself, which I need to do every now and then, that we really don't want to talk in binary terms here, as if all whites have inheritance and are doing really well and all African Americans are doing horribly. We, in preparation for this book and the nearly 200 families we talked to, as well as looking at a lot of other studies, The data is much more complicated and nuanced. As I said, most white families actually don't inherit money, and is exactly like the person that you were referencing before. It's just that whites do inherit money four times more often than African Americans do. And when they do inherit money, whether they're white or black, the African American inheritance is $30,000 less.
All right, let's talk about some of the solutions that you have considered. What's a baby bond?
Baby bond is one of my favorites. It was a policy that occurred in the United Kingdom for unfortunately too short a period of time, and then a coalition government yanked it. But essentially, baby bonds are, it's the idea that at birth, there is a combination of public and private community family investment in the well-being of that child into their adulthood. And it takes the form of an account of money literally being at birth being put into account as a baby bond, if you will, that grows normally by the miracle of compound interest, if you will. Families, communities can add to it at hallmark events, maybe at the entry of kindergarten, you know, the first summer job, volunteer work, all kinds of opportunities to grow that particular account so that by the age of 18 or so, the young adult then can use that account for higher education, whether it's a college, community college, a vocational school, anything that has to do with skill development and higher education. And then at later points in their life, could use it not too much later. They could begin to use it for home ownership, business, starting their own business, adding to their business, and then finally for retirement security. Depending upon how much money is put into the account initially and how it can grow over time, we at the institute I direct, we have done some estimates. And one of the estimates that we did shows that in what I would call a relatively modest account that grows to $30,000 by the age of that child is 18, that for that generation of young adults, the racial wealth gap is literally wiped out. Now, that's a huge investment, and, you know, I don't think anybody's going to be introducing it in a serious way other than to talk about it. It didn't get introduced in a serious way in the Obama administration, the Clinton, or the Bushes, but it's a kind of bold vision that I think helps to transform lives and families.
You call also for leveling the education playing field to reduce the disparity in outcomes between rich and poor schools. If you know how to do this, please tell us.
Well, I don't have any better ideas probably than you and a lot of our listeners. And you know, I have to stipulate that I'm not familiar with policy in school financing in Texas, but I do know that in most states in the nation, schools are extraordinary in that it's the only thing that's supported by a local and mostly property tax. All other public investments, whether it's state or federal, go into financing everything else we do as a public investment. But for some reason, our schools are really, the financing is really contingent on the community wealth, that is the value of properties in any particular community. And that's why we get, in most states in the country, such disparate levels of school financing, whether you look at it per pupil or on a per-need basis. Some of the solutions are relatively simple, but they're politically difficult in that you might ask for a greater federal role in financing. The federal government finances about 5% of public elementary, middle, and high school education at this moment. And there are a lot of states and local communities that don't want the federal government any more involved. Similarly, at the state level, there are, I know in Massachusetts and in states around me where I live, there's some fairly crude formulas that get used to kind of cut down on the school financing disparity from a wealthy community to a poorer one. But it doesn't, they don't fully account for all the disparities that exist.
You say that monetary policy should prioritize full employment over stable inflation rates that benefit companies. What would that change look like exactly?
Well, that would there are a number of different options. I think policy analysts and advocates try and point to. One is a federally guaranteed job. And two of my colleagues, Sandy Darity and Derek Hamilton, one at Duke, at the other at the New School, have been, and others have been propounding this idea for a long period of time. And what that policy really means is that for those that can't find work and that are looking for work, all right, which right now is only about 4 or 5% of the population, if we believe the Bureau of Labor Statistics reports, that for that percent of the population, the federal government is the employer of last resort. And they provide public sector jobs or other kinds of productive, constructive work for those people until they can find other work. It wouldn't be necessarily high-paying jobs if people really don't want to stay there, but that's a kind of policy, a market-based policy, if you will, that would allow and enable people who want work to be able to find it and to be paid accordingly for it.
It's interesting that you bring that up because, you know, lots of people, there are compelling arguments for cutting the size of the federal budget and therefore the size of the federal workforce. But cutting those government jobs means somewhere there will be a lot of unemployed people if this is what we choose to do.
That's what I think. And I, you know, from the sound of the way you phrased it, I think that's what you're thinking as well. The other economists, however, mostly on the right side of the political spectrum and the firmest believers in a so-called free market, make a slightly different assumption. And they assume that if the federal government, the state government, local governments cut down on their workforce, that that's going to literally drive wages down so that corporations and small businesses will be able to hire more people. And that's kind of the operative theory there. Unfortunately, I think we have had experiments with it, and it really doesn't work.
My guest is Thomas M. Shapiro, professor of law and social policy and director of the Institute on Assets and Social Policy at Brandeis University. His new book is called Toxic Inequality: How America's Wealth Gap Destroys Mobility, Deepens the Racial Divide, and Threatens Our Future. You can join us at KERA Think via email, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Tom, how can we help Americans build more robust savings for retirement? It seems for many families, you know, that are just making ends meet, it feels impossible to take a portion of those paychecks and put them away.
I think that's absolutely right. That's part of the stagnation in living standards in the United States over the last 20 and 30 years. The data tell us actually that if you look at the number of hours that are worked in a family, not just by individuals, but in a family, the percent of work hours in the last 25 years has gone up like 11 to 14%. Yes, that means maybe more women entering the labor market, but it also means more adult children. It means people working second and third jobs. It means people doing consulting and self-employment. So the reality is that most American families are compensating for this stagnation in living standards by working harder and by working longer just to stay in the same place. And part of what doesn't happen in that situation is the accumulation of savings for retirement or investment or higher education or any kind of wealth generation becomes extremely more difficult in that kind of context. There are a number, I think, of really proven constructive ways to help families generate savings for their retirement or any other purpose. One of them, and let me point to two state-level examples that actually are in jeopardy at the moment. One in the state of California, one in the state of Illinois, where employers, small and medium-sized employers that did not offer their workers access to a pension or retirement savings plan, those employers now need to offer it. And that results from statewide legislation in those two states. Those savings are shielded, if you will, from state and federal income tax at the moment. So there's incentive to do so on the part of the worker. There's incentives to do so on the part of the employer, because all the literature tells us that a happier, more satisfied employee is likely to work there longer, and the turnover is less, and the disruption of the labor force is a lot less as well. Similar policy has been suggested at the federal level. In fact, the Treasury Department, I think it was a little over 2 years ago now, there's an instrument called MIRA, M-Y-I-R-A, which is a savings instrument that was designed for exactly the situation I mentioned in Illinois and California, for those workers that worked in a workplace where their employer did not offer them access to retirement savings or pension. Those workers now can invest in this MIRA, M-Y-I-R-A scheme, savings scheme by the Treasury Department. And those savings also are shielded from federal taxes, at least until the worker takes it out or until retirement, in which case then it becomes taxed at a much lower rate. There's a ceiling. I think a worker cannot accumulate more than $15,500. I would like to see the program a lot more robust than that. I also would like to see, personally, more incentive that's put up both in terms of public investment and the employer. And finally, I would just, it's worth noting that the systems that we've been demonstrating and piloting that I think are proven tools, like that federal Department of Treasury MIRA program, what Illinois and California are doing, are only for workers. They're only for people that are deemed to be productive in the workplace and producing things. There's a lot of other very worthy, we're all worthy individuals in the society who for one reason or another may not be attached to a paid labor force and therefore are not eligible.
Do you see political will to make the kinds of changes you're talking about?
At the present moment, in a word, no. But I think that that's part of the vision in this period of time, that it's really important for people like me and others, and hopefully a lot of you, a lot of your listeners, to keep alive, because this, the period we're in now, the period of no, if you will, is going to end, and it's really important that the bold vision for the future stays alive. We keep talking about the ideas, keep experimenting with it on the local and state level, so that when the tools become even more proven at state and local level, that an argument can be made, well, maybe this would make good federal policy.
Thomas M. Shapiro is professor of law and social policy and director of the Institute on Assets and Social Policy at Brandeis University. His new book is Toxic Inequality: How America's Wealth Gap Destroys Mobility, Deepens the Racial Divide, and Threatens Our Future. Tom, it's been really interesting. Thanks for making time for us.
Thank you for having me today, and a quick shout out to all my friends in Texas.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is our technical director. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. And Jeff Whittington is executive producer. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.